if the serving girl hadn't tried to kill you by February, she hadn't any backbone. Storybooks were like gold dust. Anything you could read was treasured, back before the town had a lending library. When my grandpa got sent a storybook from his brother in Bavaria, all the Germans in town met up in the town hall to hear him read it. And the Finns and the Irish and the rest of them, they'd make the Germans tell them the stories. 20 miles south of here in Ojibwe, they found a woman walking mother naked in the winter with a dead babe at her breast, and she'd not suffer them to take it from her. He shook his head meditatively, closed the fly cabinet with a click. Bad business. You want a video rental card? Eventually they'll open a Blockbusters here, and then we'll soon be out of business, but for now we've got a pretty fair selection. Shadow reminded Hinselman that he had no television and no VCR. He enjoyed Hinselman's company, the reminiscences, the tall tales, the goblin grin of the old man. It could make things awkward between them were Shadow to admit that television had made him uncomfortable ever since it had started to talk to him. Hinselman fished in a drawer and took out a tin box. By the look of it, it had once been a Christmas box, of the kind that contained chocolates or cookies. A mottled Santa Claus, holding a tray of Coca-Cola bottles, beamed up from its lid. Hinselman eased off the metal top of the box, revealing a notebook and books of blank tickets, and said, "How many want me to put you down for?" "How many of what?" "Clunker tickets. She'll go out onto the ice today, so we've started selling tickets. Each ticket is $5, 10 for 40, 20 for 75. One ticket buys you 5 minutes. Of course, we can't promise it'll go down in your 5 minutes, but the person who's closest stands to win $500. And if it goes down in your 5 minutes, you win $1,000. The earlier you buy your tickets, the more times aren't spoken for. You want to see the info sheet?"
"Sure."
Hinselman handed Shadow a photocopied sheet. The clunker was an old car with its engine and fuel tank removed, which would be parked out on the ice for the winter. Sometime in the spring, the lake ice would melt, and when it was too thin to bear the car's weight, the car would fall into the lake. The earliest the clunker had ever tumbled into the lake was February the 27th. That was the winter of 1998. I don't think you could rightly call that a winter at all. The latest was May the 1st. That was 1950. Seemed that year that the only way that winter would end was if somebody hammered a stake through its heart. The beginning of April appeared to be the most common time for the car to sink, normally in mid-afternoon. All of the mid-afternoons in April had already gone, marked off in Hinselman's lined notebook. Shadow bought a 30-minute period on the morning of March the 23rd from 9 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. He handed Hinselman $30.
"I just wish everybody in town was as easy a sell as you are," said Hinselman.
"It's a thank you for that ride you gave me that first night I was in town."
"No, Mike," said Hinselman, "it's for the children."
For a moment he looked serious, with no trace of impishness on his creased old face.
"Come down this afternoon. You can lend a hand pushing the clunker out onto the lake."
He passed Shadow 5 blue cards, each with a date and time written on it in Hinselman's old-fashioned handwriting, then entered the details of each in his notebook.
"Hinselman," asked Shadow, "have you ever heard of Eagle Stones?"
"Up north of Rhinelander? Nope, that's Eagle River. Can't say I have."
"How about Thunderbirds?"
"Well, there was a Thunderbird framing gallery up on 5th Street, but that closed down. I'm not helping, am I?"
"Nope."
"Tell you what, why don't you go look at the library? Good people, although they may be kind of distracted by the library sale on this week. I showed you where the library was, didn't I?"
Shadow nodded and said so long. He wished he'd thought of the library himself. He got into the purple 4Runner and drove south on Main Street, following the lake around to the southernmost point, until he reached the castle-like building which housed the city library. He walked inside. A sign pointed to the basement. "Library sale," it said. The library proper was on the ground floor, and he stamped the snow off his boots and went in. A forbidding woman with pursed crimson-colored lips asked him pointedly if she could help him.
"I suppose I need a library card," he said.
"And I want to know all about Thunderbirds."
Native American beliefs and traditions were on a single shelf in one castle-like turret. Shadow pulled down some books and sat in the window seat. In several minutes he had learned that thunderbirds were mythical, gigantic birds who lived on mountaintops, who brought the lightning and who flapped their wings to make the thunder. There were some tribes, he read, who believed that the thunderbirds had made the world. Another half-hour's reading didn't turn up anything more, and he could find no mention of eagle stones anywhere in the book's indices. Shadow was putting the last of the books back on the shelf when he became aware of somebody staring at him. Someone small and grave was peeking at him from around the heavy shelves. As he turned to look, the face vanished. He turned his back on the boy, then glanced around to see that he was being watched once more. In his pocket was the Liberty dollar. He took it out of his pocket, held it up in his right hand, making sure the boy could see it. He finger-palmed it into his left hand, displayed both hands empty, raised his left hand to his mouth, and coughed once, letting the coin tumble from his left hand into his right. The boy looked at him wide-eyed and scampered away, returning a few moments later, dragging an unsmiling Marguerite Olson, who looked at Shadow suspiciously and said, "Hello, Mr. Ainsell. Leon says you were doing magic for him." "Just a little prestidigitation, ma'am. Say, I never did say thank you for your advice about heating the apartment. It's warm as toast in there right now."
"That's good."
Her icy expression had not begun to thaw. "It's a lovely library," said Shadow.
"It's a beautiful building, but the city needs something more efficient and less beautiful. You going to the library sale downstairs?"
"I wasn't planning on it."
"Well, you should. It's for a good cause."
"I'll make a point of getting down there."
"Head out into the hall and then go downstairs. Good seeing you, Mr. Ainsell."
"Call me Mike," he said. She said nothing, just took Leon's hand and walked the boy over to the children's section.
"But, Mom," Shadow heard Leon say, "it wasn't prestidigitation. It wasn't. I saw it vanish, and then it fell out of his nose. I saw it."
An oil portrait of Abraham Lincoln gazed down from the wall at him. Shadow walked down the marble and oak steps to the library basement, through a door into a large room filled with tables, each table covered with books of all kinds, indiscriminately assorted and promiscuously arranged. Paperbacks and hardcovers, fiction and nonfiction, periodicals and encyclopedias all side by side upon the tables, spines up or spines out. Shadow wandered to the back of the room, where there was a table covered with old-looking leather-bound books, each with a catalog number painted in white on the spine.
"You're the first person over in that corner all day," said the man, sitting by the stack of empty boxes and bags and the small open metal cash box. "Mostly folk just take the thrillers and the children's books and the Harlequin romances. Jenny Curtin, Danielle Steele, all that."
The man was reading Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
"Everything on the tables is 50 cents a book, or you can take three for a dollar."
Shadow thanked him and continued to browse. He found a copy of Herodotus's histories bound in peeling brown leather. It made him think of the paperback copy he had left behind in prison. There was a book called Perplexing Parlor Illusions, which looked like it might have some coin effects. He carried both the books over to the man with the cash box.
"Buy one more, it's still a dollar," said the man, "and if you take another book away, you'll be doing us a favor. We need the shelf space."
Shadow walked back to the old leather-bound books. He decided to liberate the book that was least likely to be bought by anyone else, and found himself unable to decide between Common Diseases of the Urinary Tract with Illustrations by a Medical Doctor, and Minutes of the Lakeside City Council, 1872-1884. He looked at the illustrations in the medical book and decided that somewhere in the town there was a teenage boy who could use the book to gross out his friends. He took the minutes to the man on the door, who took his dollar and put all the books into a Dave's Finest Food brown paper sack. Shadow left the library. He had a clear view of the lake all the way back. He could even see his apartment building, like a doll's house, up past the bridge. and there were men on the ice near the bridge, four or five of them, pushing a dark green car into the center of the White Lake.
March the 23rd. Shadow said to the lake under his breath, 9 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. He wondered if the lake or the clunker could hear him, and if they would pay any attention to him, even if they could. He doubted it. The wind blew bitter against his face. Officer Chad Mulligan was waiting outside Shadow's apartment when he got back. Shadow's heart began to pound when he saw the police car, to relax a little when he observed that the policeman was doing paperwork in the front seat. He walked over to the car, carrying his paper sack of books. Mulligan lowered his window.
"Library sale?" he said.
"Yes.
I bought a box of Robert Ludlum books there 2-3 years back. Keep meaning to read them. My cousin swears by the guy. These days I figure if I ever get marooned on a desert island, and I got my box of Robert Ludlum books with me, I can catch up on my reading."
"Something particular I can do for you, Chief?"
"Not a damn thing, pal. Thought I'd stop by and see how you were settling in. You remember that Chinese saying, you save a man's life, you're responsible for him? Well, I'm not saying I saved your life last week, but I still thought I should check in. How's the purple Gunther-mobile doing?"
"Good," said Shadow. "It's good. Running fine."
"Pleased to hear it."
"I saw my next-door neighbor in the library," said Shadow. "Miss Olson. I was wondering what crawled up her butt and died?"
"If you want to put it like that."
"Long story. You want to ride along for a spell? I'll tell you all about it."
Shadow thought about it for a moment.
"Okay," he said.
He got into the car, sat in the front passenger seat. Mulligan drove north of town, then he turned off his lights and parked beside the road.
"Darren Olson met Marge at UW Stevens Point, and he brought her back north to Lakeside. She was a journalism major. He was studying, shit, hotel management, something like that. When they got here, jaws dropped. This was, what, 13-14 years ago? She was so beautiful. That black hair..." He paused. "Darren managed the Motel America over in Camden, 20 miles west of here, except nobody ever seemed to want to stop in Camden, and eventually the motel closed. They had two boys. At that time, Sandy was 11. The little one, Leon, is it, was just a babe in arms. Darren Olson wasn't a brave man. He'd been a good high school football player, but that was the last time he was flying high. Whatever. He couldn't find the courage to tell Margie that he'd lost his job, so for a month, maybe for 2 months, he'd drive off early in the morning, come home late in the evening, complaining about the hard day he'd had at the motel."
"What was he doing?" asked Shadow.
"Couldn't say for certain. I reckon he was driving up to Ironwood, maybe down to Green Bay. Guess he started out as a job hunter. Pretty soon he was drinking the time away, getting stoned, more than probably meeting the occasional working girl for a little instant gratification. He could have been gambling. What I do know for certain is that he emptied out their joint account in about 10 weeks. It was only a matter of time before Margie figured out. There we go!"
He swung the car out, flicked on the siren and the lights, and scared the daylights out of a small man in a car with Iowa plates who had just come down the hill at 70. The rogue Iowan ticketed, Mulligan returned to his story.
"Where was I? Okay, so Margie kicks him out, sues for divorce. It turned into a vicious custody battle. That's what they call 'em when they get into People magazine. Vicious custody battle. She got the kids, Darren got visitation rights, and precious little else. Now, back then Leon was pretty small. Sandy was older, a good kid, the kind of boy who worships his daddy. Wouldn't let Margie say nothing bad about him. They lost the house, had a nice place down on Daniels Road. She moved into the apartments. He left town, came back every few months to make everybody miserable. This went on for a few years. He'd come back, spend money on the kids, leave Margie in tears. Most of us just started wishing he'd never come back at all. His mom and pop had moved to Florida when they retired, said they couldn't take another Wisconsin winter. So last year he came out, said he wanted to take the boys to Florida for Christmas. Margie said not a hope, told him to get lost. It got pretty unpleasant. At one point I had to go over there. Domestic dispute.
By the time I got there, Darren was standing in the front yard shouting stuff. The boys were barely holding it together. Margie was crying. I told Darren he was shaping up for a night in the cells. I thought for a moment he was going to hit me, but he was sober enough not to do that. I gave him a ride down to the trailer park south of town, told him to shape up, that he'd hurt her enough. Next day he left town. 2 weeks later, Sandy vanished. Didn't get onto the school bus. Told his best friend that he'd be seeing his dad soon, that Darren was bringing him a specially cool present to make up for having missed Christmas in Florida. Nobody's seen him since. Non-custodial kidnappings are the hardest. It's tough to find a kid who doesn't want to be found, you see. Shadow said that he did. He saw something else as well. Chad Mulligan was in love with Marguerite Olsen himself. He wondered if the man knew how obvious it was. Mulligan pulled out once more, lights flashing, and pulled over some teenagers doing 60. He didn't ticket them. Just put the fear of God in them. That evening, Shadow sat at the kitchen table trying to figure out how to transform a silver dollar into a penny. It was a trick he had found in Perplexing Parlor Illusions, but the instructions were infuriating, unhelpful, and vague. Phrases like, "then vanish the penny in the usual way," occurred every sentence or so. In this context, Shadow wondered, what was the usual way? A French drop, sleeving it? Shouting, "Oh my God, look out, a mountain lion," and dropping the coin into his side pocket while the audience's attention was diverted? He tossed his silver dollar into the air, caught it, remembering the moon and the woman who gave it to him. Then he attempted the illusion. It didn't seem to work. He walked into the bathroom and tried it in front of the mirror and confirmed that he was right. The trick, as written, simply didn't work. He sighed, dropped the coins in his pocket, and sat down on the couch. He spread the cheap throw rug over his legs and flipped open the Minutes of the Lakeside Council, 1872 to 1884. The type, in two columns, was so small as to be almost unreadable. He flipped through the book, looking at the reproductions of the photographs of the period, at the several incarnations of the Lakeside City Council therein, long side whiskers and clay pipes and battered hats and shiny hats worn with faces which were, many of them, peculiarly familiar. He was unsurprised to see that the portly secretary of the 1882 City Council was a Patrick Mulligan. Shave him, make him lose 20 pounds, and he'd be a dead ringer for Chad Mulligan, his, what, great-great-grandson? He wondered if Hinselman's pioneer grandfather was in the photographs, but it didn't appear that he had been city council material. Shadow thought he had seen a reference to a Hinselman in the text while flipping from photograph to photograph, but it eluded him when he leafed back for it, and the tiny type made Shadow's eyes ache. He put the book down on his chest and realized his head was nodding. It would be foolish to fall asleep on the couch, he decided soberly. The bedroom was only a few feet away. On the other hand, the bedroom and the bed would still be there in 5 minutes, and anyway, he was not going to go to sleep. Only to close his eyes. For a moment. Darkness roared. He stood on an open plain. Beside him was the place from which he had once emerged, from which the earth had squeezed him. Stars were still falling from the sky, and each star that touched the red earth became a man or a woman. The men had long black hair and high cheekbones. The women all looked like Marguerite Olsen. These were the star people. They looked at him with dark, proud eyes. "Tell me about the Thunderbirds," said Shadow. "Please, it's not for me, it's for my wife." One by one they turned their backs on him, and as he lost their faces they were gone, one with the landscape. But the last of them, her hair streaked white on dark gray, pointed before she turned away, pointed into the wine-colored sky. "Ask them yourself," she said. Summer lightning flickered.
momentarily illuminating the landscape from horizon to horizon. There were high rocks near him, peaks and spires of sandstone, and Shadow began to climb the nearest. The spire was the color of old ivory. He grabbed at a handhold and felt it slice into his hand. It's bone, thought Shadow, not stone. It's old, dry bone. It was a dream, and in dreams you have no choices. Either there are no decisions to be made, or they were made for you long before ever the dream began. Shadow continued to climb. His hands hurt. Bone popped and crushed and fragmented under his bare feet. The wind tugged at him, and he pressed himself to the spire, and he continued to climb the tower. It was made of only one kind of bone, he realized. Repeated over and over, each of the bones was dry and ball-like. But another flare of lightning told him differently. They had holes for eyes, and they had teeth, which grinned without humor. Somewhere birds were calling. Rain spattered his face. He was hundreds of feet above the ground, clinging to the side of the tower of skulls, while flashes of lightning burned in the wings of the shadowy birds who circled the spire, enormous black condor-like birds, each with a ruff of white at its neck. They were huge, graceful, awful birds, and the beats of their wings crashed like thunder on the night air. They were circling the spire. They must be 15, 20 feet from wingtip to wingtip, thought Shadow. Then the first bird swung out of its glide toward him, blue lightning crackling in its wings. He pushed himself into a crevice of skulls. Hollow eye-holes stared at him. A clutter of ivory teeth smiled at him. But he kept climbing, pulling himself up the mountain of skulls, every sharp edge cutting into his skin, feeling revulsion and terror and awe. Another bird came at him, and one hand-sized talon sank into his arm. He reached out and tried to grasp a feather from its wing, for if he returned to his tribe, without a thunderbird's feather he would be disgraced, he would never be a man. But the bird pulled up so that he could not grasp a feather. The thunderbird loosened its grip and swung back onto the wind. Shadow continued to climb. There must be 1,000 skulls, thought Shadow, 1,000,000, and not all of them are human. He stood at last on the top of the spire. The great birds, the thunderbirds, circling him slowly, navigating the gusts of the storm with tiny flicks of their wings. He heard a voice, the voice of the buffalo man, calling to him on the wind, telling him who the skulls belonged to. The tower began to tumble, and the biggest bird, its eyes the blinding blue-white of forked lightning, plummeted down toward him in a rush of thunder, and Shadow was falling, tumbling down the tower of skulls. The telephone shrilled. Shadow had not even known that it was connected. Groggy, shaken, he picked it up.
"What the fuck?" shouted Wednesday, angrier than Shadow had ever heard him. "What the almighty flying fuck do you think you are playing at?"
"I was asleep," said Shadow into the receiver, stupidly.
"What do you think is the fucking point of stashing you in a hiding place like Lakeside, if you're going to raise such a ruckus that not even a dead man could miss it?"
"I dreamed of thunderbirds," said Shadow, "and a tower. Skulls." It seemed to him very important to recount his dream.
"I know what you were dreaming. Everybody damn well knows what you were dreaming. Christ almighty, what's the point in hiding you if you're going to start to fucking advertise?"
Shadow said nothing. There was a pause at the other end of the telephone.
"I'll be there in the morning," said Wednesday.
It sounded like the anger had died down.
"We're going to San Francisco. The flowers in your hair are optional."
And the line went dead. Shadow put the telephone down on the carpet and sat up stiffly. It was 6 a.m. and still night dark outside. He got up from the sofa, shivering. He could hear the wind as it screamed across the frozen lake, and he could hear somebody nearby crying. Only the thickness of a wall away, he was certain it was Marguerite Olsen. And her sobbing was insistent and low and heartbreaking. Shadow walked into the bathroom and pissed, then went into his bedroom and closed the door, blocking off the sound of the crying woman. Outside, the wind howled and wailed as if it, too, was seeking a lost child. San Francisco in January was unseasonably warm, warm enough that the sweat prickled on the back of Shadow's neck. Wednesday was wearing a deep blue suit and a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles that made him look like an entertainment lawyer. They were walking along Haight Street. The street people and the hustlers and the moochers watched them go by, and no one shook a paper cup of change at them. No one asked them for anything at all. Wednesday's jaw was set. Shadow had seen immediately that the man was still angry and had asked no questions when the black Lincoln town car had pulled up outside the apartment that morning. They had not talked on the way to the airport. He'd been relieved that Wednesday was in first class and he was back in coach. Now it was late in the afternoon. Shadow, who hadn't been in San Francisco since he was a boy, who had only seen it since then as a background to movies, was astonished at how familiar it was, how colorful and unique the wooden houses, how steep the hills, how very much it didn't feel like anywhere else. "It's almost hard to believe that this is in the same country as Lakeside," he said. Wednesday glared at him, then he said, "It's not. San Francisco isn't in the same country as Lakeside any more than New Orleans is in the same country as New York, or Miami is in the same country as Minneapolis."
"Is that so?" said Shadow mildly.
"Indeed it is. They may share certain cultural signifiers, money, a federal government, entertainment. It's the same land, obviously, but the only things that give it the illusion of being one country are the Greenback, the Tonight Show, and McDonald's."
They were approaching a park at the end of the road. "Be nice to the lady we're visiting, but not too nice."
"I'll be cool," said Shadow. They stepped onto the grass. A young girl, no older than 14, her hair dyed green and orange and pink, stared at them as they went by. She sat beside a dog, a mongrel, with a piece of string for a collar and a leash. She looked hungrier than the dog did. The dog yapped at them, then wagged its tail. Shadow gave the girl a dollar bill. She stared at it, as if she wasn't sure what it was.
"Buy dog food with it," Shadow suggested. She nodded and smiled.
"Let me put it bluntly," said Wednesday. "You must be very cautious around the lady we are visiting. She might take a fancy to you, and that would be bad."
"Is she your girlfriend or something?"
"Not for all the little plastic toys in China," said Wednesday, agreeably. His anger seemed to have dissipated, or perhaps to have been invested for the future. Shadow suspected that anger was the engine that made Wednesday run.
There was a woman sitting on the grass under a tree, with a paper tablecloth spread in front of her, and a variety of Tupperware dishes on the cloth. She was not fat, no, far from fat. What she was, a word that Shadow had never had cause to use until now, was curvaceous. Her hair was so fair that it was white, the kind of platinum blonde tresses that should have belonged to a long dead movie starlet. Her lips were painted crimson, and she looked to be somewhere between 25 and 50. As they reached her, she was selecting from a plate of deviled eggs. She looked up as Wednesday approached her and put down the egg she had chosen and wiped her hand.
"Hello, you old fraud," she said. But she smiled as she said it, and Wednesday bowed low, took her hand, and raised it to his lips. He said, "You look divine." "How the hell else should I look?" she demanded, sweetly. "Anyway, you're a liar. New Orleans was such a mistake. I put on, what, 30 pounds there? I swear. I knew I had to leave when I started to waddle. The tops of my thighs rubbed together when I walk now. Can you believe that?"
This last was addressed to Shadow. He had no idea what to say in reply, and felt a hot flush suffuse his face.
The woman laughed delightedly. "He's blushing. Wednesday, my sweet, you brought me a blusher. How perfectly wonderful of you. What's he called?"
"This is Shadow," said Wednesday. He seemed to be enjoying Shadow's discomfort.
"Shadow, say hello to Easter."
Shadow said something that might have been hello, and the woman smiled at him again. He felt like he was caught in headlights, the blinding kind that poachers use to freeze deer before they shoot them. He could smell her perfume from where he was standing, an intoxicating mixture of jasmine and honeysuckle, of sweet milk and female skin.
"So how's tricks?" asked Wednesday.
The woman, Easter, laughed a deep and throaty laugh, full-bodied and joyous. How could you not like someone who laughed like that?
"Everything's fine," she said. "How about you, you old wolf?"
"I was hoping to enlist your assistance."
"Wasting your time."
"At least hear me out before dismissing me."
"No point. Don't even bother."
She looked at Shadow. "Please sit down here and help yourself to some of this food. Here, take a plate and pile it high. It's all good. Eggs, roast chicken, chicken curry, chicken salad, and over here is lapin. Rabbit, actually, but cold rabbit is a delight. And in that bowl over there is the jugged hare. Well, why don't I just fill a plate for you?" And she did, taking a plastic plate, piling it high with food, and passing it to him. Then she looked at Wednesday.
"Are you eating?"
she asked.
"I am at your disposal, my dear," said Wednesday.
"You," she told him, "are so full of shit it's a wonder your eyes don't turn brown."
She passed him an empty plate.
"Help yourself," she said.
The afternoon sun at her back burned her hair into a platinum aura.
"Shadow," she said, chewing a chicken leg with gusto, "that's a sweet name. Why do they call you Shadow?"
Shadow licked his lips to moisten them. "When I was a kid," he said, "we lived, my mother and I, she was, well, like a secretary at a bunch of U.S. embassies. We went from city to city all over Northern Europe. Then she got sick and had to take early retirement, and we came back to the States. I never knew what to say to the other kids, so I'd just find adults and follow them around, not saying anything. I just needed the company, I guess. I don't know. I was a small kid."
"You grew," she said.
"Yes," said Shadow, "I grew."
She turned back to Wednesday, who was spooning down a bowl of what looked like cold gumbo.
"Is this the boy who's got everybody so upset?"
"You heard?"
"I keep my ears pricked up," she said.
Then to Shadow,
"You keep out of their way. There are too many secret societies out there, and they have no loyalties and no love. Commercial, independent, government, they're all in the same boat. They range from the barely competent to the deeply dangerous. Hey, old wolf, I heard a joke you'd like the other day. How do you know the CIA wasn't involved in the Kennedy assassination?"
"I've heard it," said Wednesday.
"Pity."
She turned her attention back to Shadow.
"But the spook show, the ones you met, they're something else. They exist because everyone knows they must exist."
She drained a paper cup of something that looked like white wine, and then she got to her feet.
"Shadow's a good name," she said. "I want a mochaccino. Come on."
She began to walk away.
"What about the food?" asked Wednesday. "You can't just leave it here."
She smiled at him and pointed to the girl sitting by the dog, and then extended her arms to take in the hate and the world.
"Let it feed them," she said.
And she walked, with Wednesday and Shadow trailing behind her.
"Remember," she said to Wednesday as they walked, "I'm rich. I'm doing just peachy. Why should I help you?"
"You're one of us," he said. "You're as forgotten and as unloved and unremembered as any of us. It's pretty clear whose side you should be on."
They reached a sidewalk coffee house, went inside, sat down. There was only one waitress, who wore her eyebrow ring as a mark of caste, and a woman making coffee behind the counter.
The waitress advanced upon them, smiling automatically, sat them down, took their orders. Easter put her slim hand on the back of Wednesday's square, gray hand.
"I'm telling you," she said, "I'm doing fine. On my festival days they still feast on eggs and rabbits, on candy and on flesh, to represent rebirth and copulation. They wear flowers in their bonnets, and they give each other flowers. They do it in my name, more and more of them every year, in my name, old wolf."
"And you wax fat and affluent on their worship and their love?" he said dryly.
"Don't be an asshole."
Suddenly she sounded very tired. She sipped her mochaccino. "Serious question, my dear. Certainly I would agree that millions upon millions of them give each other tokens in your name, and that they still practice all the rites of your festival, even down to hunting for hidden eggs. But how many of them know who you are, eh?" "Excuse me, miss," this to the waitress. She said,
"You need another espresso?"
"No, my dear, I was just wondering if you could solve a little argument we were having over here. My friend and I were disagreeing over what the word Easter means. Would you happen to know?" The girl stared at him as if green toads had begun to push their way between his lips. Then she said,
"I don't know about any of that Christian stuff. I'm a pagan."
The woman behind the counter said,
"I think it's like Latin or something for Christ has risen, maybe."
"Really?" said Wednesday.
"Yeah, sure," said the woman. "Easter, just like the sun rises in the east, you know."
"The risen sun, of course, a most logical supposition." The woman smiled and returned to her coffee grinder. Wednesday looked up at their waitress. "I think I shall have another espresso, if you do not mind. And tell me, as a pagan, who do you worship?"
"Worship?"
"That's right. I imagine you must have a pretty wide-open field. So to whom do you set up your household altar? To whom do you bow down? To whom do you pray at dawn and at dusk?" Her lips described several shapes without saying anything before she said,
"The female principle. It's an empowerment thing, you know."
"Indeed. And this female principle of yours, does she have a name?"
"She's the goddess within us all," said the girl with the eyebrow ring, color rising to her cheek. "She doesn't need a name."
"Ah," said Wednesday, with a wide monkey grin, "so do you have mighty bacchanals in her honor? Do you drink blood wine under the full moon while scarlet candles burn in silver candle holders? Do you step naked into the sea foam, chanting ecstatically to your nameless goddess while the waves lick at your legs, lapping your thighs like the tongues of a thousand leopards?"
"You're making fun of me," she said. "We don't do any of that stuff you were saying."
She took a deep breath. Shadow suspected she was counting to 10.
"Any more coffees here? Another mochaccino for you, ma'am?"
Her smile was a lot like the one she had greeted them with when they had entered. They shook their heads, and the waitress turned to greet another customer. "There," said Wednesday, "is one who does not have the faith and will not have the fun. Chesterton. Pagan indeed. So, shall we go out onto the street, Easter, my dear, and repeat the exercise? Find out how many passers-by know that their Easter festival takes its name from Eostra of the Dawn? Let's see, I have it. We shall ask 100 people. For every one that knows the truth, you may cut off one of my fingers, and when I run out of them, toes. For every 20 who don't know, you spend a night making love to me. And the odds are certainly in your favor here. This is San Francisco, after all. There are heathens and pagans and Wiccans aplenty on these precipitous streets." Her green eyes looked at Wednesday. They were, Shadow decided, the exact same color as a leaf in spring with the sun shining through it. She said nothing. "We could try it," continued Wednesday, "but I would end up with 10 fingers, 10 toes, and 5 nights in your bed. So don't tell me they worship you and keep your festival day. They mouth your name, but it has no meaning to them. Nothing at all." Tears stood out in her eyes.
"I know that," she said quietly. "I'm not a fool."
"No," said Wednesday, "you're not." "He's pushed her too far," thought Shadow. Wednesday looked down, ashamed. "I'm sorry,"
he said. Shadow could hear the real sincerity in his voice. We need you. We need your energy. We need your power. Will you fight beside us when the storm comes? She hesitated. She had a chain of blue forget-me-nots tattooed around her left wrist.
Yes, she said after a while. I guess I will.
I guess it's true what they say, thought Shadow. If you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. Then he felt guilty for thinking it. Wednesday kissed his finger, touched it to Easter's cheek. He called their waitress over and paid for their coffees, counting out the money carefully, folding it over with the check and presenting it to her. As she walked away, Shadow said, "Ma'am, excuse me, I think you dropped this." He picked up a $10 bill from the floor.
"Now,"
she said, looking at the wrapped bills in her hand. "I saw it fall, ma'am," said Shadow politely. "You should count them." She counted the money in her hand, looked puzzled, and said,
"Jesus, you're right. I'm sorry."
She took the $10 bill from Shadow and walked away. Easter walked out onto the sidewalk with him. The light was just starting to fade. She nodded to Wednesday, then she touched Shadow's hand and said,
"What did you dream about last night?"
"Thunderbirds," he said. "A mountain of skulls." She nodded.
"And do you know whose skulls they were?"
"There was a voice," he said. "In my dream, it told me." She nodded and waited. He said, "It said they were mine. Old skulls of mine, thousands and thousands of them." She looked at Wednesday and said,
"I think this one's a keeper."
She smiled her bright smile. Then she patted Shadow's arm and walked away down the sidewalk. He watched her go, trying and failing not to think of her thighs rubbing together as she walked. In the taxi on the way to the airport, Wednesday turned to Shadow. "What the hell was that business with the $10 about?" "You shortchanged her. It comes out of her wages if she's short." "What the hell do you care?" Wednesday seemed genuinely irate. Shadow thought for a moment, then he said, "Well, I wouldn't want anyone to do it to me. She hadn't done anything wrong." "No?" Wednesday stared off into the middle distance and said, "When she was 7 years old, she shut a kitten in a closet. She listened to it mew for several days. When it ceased to mew, she took it out of the closet, put it into a shoebox, and buried it in the backyard. She wanted to bury something. She consistently steals from everywhere she works, small amounts, usually. Last year she visited her grandmother in the nursing home to which the old woman is confined. She took an antique gold watch from her grandmother's bedside table, and then went prowling through several of the other rooms, stealing small quantities of money and personal effects from the twilight folk in their golden years. When she got home, she did not know what to do with her spoils, scared someone would come after her, so she threw everything away, except the cash."
"I get the idea," said Shadow. "She also has asymptomatic gonorrhea," said Wednesday. "She suspects she might be infected, but does nothing about it. When her last boyfriend accused her of having given him a disease, she was hurt, offended, and refused to see him again."
"This isn't necessary," said Shadow. "I said I get the idea. You could do this to anyone, couldn't you? Tell me bad things about them."
"Of course," agreed Wednesday. "They all do the same things. They may think their sins are original, but for the most part they are petty and repetitive."
"And that makes it okay for you to steal $10 from her?" Wednesday paid the taxi, and the two men walked into the airport, wandered up to their gate. Boarding had not yet begun. Wednesday said, "What the hell else can I do? They don't sacrifice rams or bulls to me. They don't send me the souls of killers and slaves, gallows hung and raven picked. They made me, they forgot me. Now I take a little back from them, isn't that fair?"
"My mom used to say, 'Life isn't fair,'" said Shadow.
"Of course she did," said Wednesday. "It's one of those things that moms say, right up there with, 'If all your friends jumped off a cliff, would you do it too?'"
"You stiffed that girl for $10. I slipped her $10, said Shadow doggedly. "It was the right thing to do."
Someone announced that their plane was boarding. Wednesday stood up. "May your choices always be so clear," he said. The cold snap was easing when Wednesday dropped Shadow off in the small hours of the morning. It was still obscenely cold in Lakeside, but it was no longer impossibly cold. The lighted sign on the side of the M&I Bank flashed alternately 3:30 a.m. and minus 5 degrees Fahrenheit as they drove through the town. It was 9:30 a.m. when Chief of Police Chad Mulligan knocked on the apartment door and asked Shadow if he knew a girl named Allison McGovern. "I don't think so," said Shadow sleepily. "This is her picture," said Mulligan. It was a high school photograph. Shadow recognized the person in the picture immediately, the girl with the blue rubber band braces on her teeth, the one who had been learning all about the oral uses of Alka-Seltzer from her friend. "Oh, yeah, okay. She was on the bus when I came into town." "Where were you yesterday, Mr. Ainsell?" Shadow felt his world begin to spin away from him. He knew he had nothing to feel guilty about. "You're a parole-violating felon living under an assumed name," whispered a calm voice in his mind. "Isn't that enough?" "San Francisco," he said. "California, helping my uncle transport a four-poster bed." "You got any ticket stubs, anything like that?" "Sure." He had both his boarding pass stubs in his back pocket, pulled them out. "What's going on?" Chad Mulligan examined the boarding passes. "Allison McGovern's vanished. She helped out up at the Lakeside Humane Society, feed animals, walk dogs. She'd come out for a few hours after school, so Dolly Knopf, who runs the Humane Society, she'd always run her home when they closed up for the night. Yesterday, Allison never got there." "She's vanished." "Yep. Her parents called us last night. Silly kid used to hitchhike up to the Humane Society. It's out on County W, pretty isolated. Her parents told her not to, but this isn't the kind of place where things happen. People here don't lock their doors, you know. And you can't tell kids, so look at the photo again." Allison McGovern was smiling. The rubber bands on her teeth in the photograph were red, not blue. "You can honestly say you didn't kidnap her, rape her, murder her, anything like that?" "I was in San Francisco, and I wouldn't do that shit." "That was what I figured, pal, so you want to come help us look for her?" "Me? You. We've had the canine guys out this morning, nothing so far." He sighed. "Heck, Mike, I just hope she turns up in the Twin Cities with some dopey boyfriend." "You think it's likely?" "I think it's possible. You want to join the hunting party?" Shadow remembered seeing the girl in Henning's Farm and Home Supplies, the flash of a shy, blue-braced smile, how beautiful he had known she was going to be one day. "I'll come," he said. There were 24 men and women waiting in the lobby of the fire station. Shadow recognized Hinselman, and several other faces looked familiar. There were police officers and some men and women in the brown uniforms of the Lumber County Sheriff's Department. Chad Mulligan told them what Allison was wearing when she vanished, a scarlet snowsuit, green gloves, blue woolen hat under the hood of her snowsuit, and divided the volunteers into groups of three. Shadow, Hinselman, and a man named Brogan comprised one of the groups. They were reminded how short the daylight period was, told that if, God forbid, they found Allison's body, they were not to disturb anything, just to radio back for help, but that if she was alive, they were to keep her warm until help came. They were dropped off out on County W. Hinselman, Brogan, and Shadow walked along the edge of a frozen creek. Each group of three had been issued a small handheld walkie-talkie before they left. The cloud cover was low, and the world was gray. No snow had fallen in the last 36 hours. Footprints stood out in the glittering crust of the crisp snow. Brogan looked like a retired army colonel, with his slim mustache and white temples. He drove them, told Shadow he was a retired high school principal. "I wasn't getting any younger. These days I still teach a little, do the school play. That was always the high point of the year anyhow, and now I hunt a little and have a cabin down on Pike Lake. Spend too much time there." As they set out, Brogan said, "On the one hand, I hope we find her. On the other, if she's going to be found, I'd be very grateful if it was someone else who got to find her and not us. You know what I mean." Shadow knew exactly what he meant. The three men didn't talk much. They walked, looking for a red snowsuit or green gloves or a blue hat or a white body. Now and again, Brogan, who had the walkie-talkie, would check in with Chad Mulligan. At lunchtime, they sat with the rest of the search party on a commandeered school bus and ate hot dogs and drank hot soup. Someone pointed out a red-tailed hawk in a bare tree, and someone else said that it looked more like a falcon, but it flew away, and the argument was abandoned. Hinselman told them a story about his grandfather's trumpet, and how he tried playing it during a cold snap, and the weather was so cold outside by the barn where his grandfather had gone to practice that no music came out. "Then after he came inside, he put the trumpet down by the wood stove to thaw. Well, the family are all in bed that night, and suddenly the unfrozen tunes start coming out of that trumpet. Scared my grandmother so much she nearly had kittens." The afternoon was endless, unfruitful, and depressing. The daylight faded slowly. Distances collapsed, and the world turned indigo, and the wind blew cold enough to burn the skin on your face. When it was too dark to continue, Mulligan radioed to them to call it off for the evening, and they were picked up and driven back to the fire station. In the block next to the fire station was the Buck Stops Here Tavern, and that was where most of the searchers wound up. They were exhausted and dispirited, talking to each other of how cold it had become, how more than likely Allison would show up in a day or so, no idea of how much trouble she'd caused everyone. "You shouldn't think badly of the town because of this," said Brogan. "It is a good town."
"Lakeside," said a trim woman whose name Shadow had forgotten, if ever they'd been introduced, "is the best town in the North Woods. You know how many people are unemployed in Lakeside?"
"No," said Shadow.
"Less than 20," she said. "There's over 5,000 people live in and around this town. We may not be rich, but everyone's working. It's not like the mining towns up in the Northeast. Most of them are ghost towns now. There were farming towns that were killed by the falling cost of milk or the low price of hogs. You know what the biggest cause of unnatural death is among farmers in the Midwest?"
"Suicide?" Shadow hazarded. She looked almost disappointed.
"Yeah, that's it. They kill themselves."
She shook her head. Then she continued,
"There are too many towns hereabouts that only exist for the hunters and the vacationers, towns that just take their money and send them home with their trophies and their bug bites. Then there are the company towns, where everything's just hunky-dory until Walmart relocates their distribution center, or 3M stops manufacturing CD cases there, or whatever, and suddenly there's a boatload of folks who can't pay their mortgages. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name."
"Ainsel," said Shadow. "Mike Ainsel." The beer he was drinking was a local brew made with spring water. It was good.
"I'm Callie Knopf," she said, "Dolly's sister."
Her face was still ruddy from the cold.
"So what I'm saying is that Lakeside's lucky. We've got a little of everything here. Farm, light industry, tourism, crafts, good schools."
Shadow looked at her in puzzlement. There was something empty at the bottom of all her words. It was as if he were listening to a salesman, a good salesman, who believed in his product, but still wanted to make sure you went home with all the brushes or the full set of encyclopedias. Perhaps she could see it in his face. She said,
"I'm sorry. When you love something, you just don't want to stop talking about it. What do you do, Mr. Ainsel?"
"My uncle buys and sells antiques all over the country. He uses me to move big, heavy things. It's a good job, but not steady work." A black cat, the bar mascot, wound between Shadow's legs, rubbing its forehead on his boot. It leaped up beside him onto the bench and went to sleep.
"At least you get to travel," said Brogan. "You do anything else?"
"You got 8 quarters on you?" asked Shadow. Brogan fumbled for his change. He found 5 quarters, pushed them across the table to Shadow. Kali Knopf produced another 3 quarters. He laid out the coins, 4 in each row. Then, with scarcely a fumble, he did the coins through the table, appearing to drop half the coins through the wood of the table from his left hand into his right. After that he put the nickel away, divided the quarters into 2 piles of 4. He took all 8 coins in his right hand, an empty water glass in his left, covered the glass with a napkin, and appeared to make the coins vanish from his right hand and land in the glass beneath the napkin with an audible clink. Finally, he opened his right hand to show it was empty, then swept the napkin away to show the coins in the glass. He returned their coins, 3 to Callie, 5 to Brogan, then took a quarter back from Brogan's hand, leaving 4 coins. He blew on it, and it was a penny, which he gave to Brogan, who counted his quarters and was dumbfounded to find that he still had all 5 in his hand.
"You're a Houdini," cackled Hinselman in delight. "That's what you are."
"Just an amateur," said Shadow. "I've got a long way to go." Still, he felt a whisper of pride. They had been his first adult audience. He stopped at the food store on the way home to buy a carton of milk. The ginger-haired girl on the checkout counter looked familiar, and her eyes were red-rimmed from crying. Her face was one big freckle. "I know you," said Shadow. "You're..." And he was about to say, "the Alka-Seltzer girl," but bit it back and finished. "You're Allison's friend from the bus. I hope she's going to be okay." She sniffed and nodded.
"Me too."
She blew her nose on a tissue, hard, and pushed it back into her sleeve. Her badge said, "Hi, I'm Sophie. Ask me how you can lose 20 pounds in 30 days. "I spent today looking for her. No luck yet." Sophie nodded, blinked back tears. She waved the milk carton in front of a scanner, and it chirped its price at them. Shadow passed her $2.
"I'm leaving this fucking town,"
said the girl in a sudden, choked voice.
"I'm going to live with my mom in Ashland. Allison's gone. Sandy Olson went last year. Joe Ming the year before that. What if it's me next year?"
"I thought Sandy Olson was taken by his father."
"Yes," said the girl bitterly. "I'm sure he was. And Joe Ming went out to California, and Sarah Lindquist got lost on a trail hike, and they never found her. Whatever. I want to go to Ashland."
She took a deep breath and held it for a moment. Then, unexpectedly, she smiled at him. There was nothing insincere about that smile. It was just, he guessed, that she had been told to smile when she gave somebody change. She told him to have a nice day. Then she turned to the woman with a full shopping cart behind him and began to unload and scan. Shadow took his milk and drove away, past the gas station and the clunker on the ice, and over the bridge and home. Coming to America, 1778.
"There was a girl, and her uncle sold her," wrote Mr. Ibis in his perfect copper-plate handwriting. "That is the tale. The rest is detail. There are accounts which, if we open our hearts to them, will cut us too deeply. Look, here is a good man, good by his own lights and the lights of his friends. He is faithful and true to his wife. He adores and lavishes attention on his little children. He cares about his country. He does his job punctiliously, as best he can. So, efficiently and good-naturedly, he exterminates Jews. He appreciates the music that plays in the background to pacify them. He advises the Jews not to forget their identification numbers as they go into the showers. Many people, he tells them, forget their numbers and take the wrong clothes when they come out of the showers. This calms the Jews. There will be life, they assure themselves, after the showers.
Our man supervises the detail taking the bodies to the ovens, and if there is anything he feels bad about, it is that he still allows the gassing of vermin to affect him. Were he a truly good man,